Most importantly for me is always, if you invest the time in setting up a process like that, it only really works if you try to stick to it, right? So asking the questions consistently that you determine to be important is one thing. And then also, what do you use with this? What do you do with this feedback?
My name is Katharina, and I'm the Community and Event Manager at eCulture, a company that is on a mission to shape the world of unbiased hiring. Welcome to the Oops, I'm Biased podcast. On today's episode of the Oops, I'm Biased podcast, I am talking to Linda Hermannspann. She is the senior recruiter for EMEA at HashiCorp. She'll give an introduction to herself, so I don't need to say too much, but we are once again back with the TA Leader series talking about best practices in unbiased recruitment. Today with Linda, we are covering unbiased interview processes. So what does it mean? Bias in interviews and interviewer training. She has a lot of experience with training hiring managers and leading the charge as TA in her company to do a lot of the building awareness around bias in interviews. We're also going to talk about diversity metrics. Are they valuable? Are they not valuable? How does HashiCorp use them, especially to celebrate their own workforce? And then lastly, we're also going to talk about stakeholder management. So managing hiring managers' expectations, stakeholder management as a recruiter, how does it play a role into D&I in recruitment? And how to establish strong relationships with your stakeholders in the process. And then she has lots of best practices to share. So I really encourage you to listen. It's a bit of a longer episode, but I assure you it's worth it. So without further ado, I really hope you enjoy this episode. All right. Welcome back to the Oops, I'm Biased podcast. Today, I have the pleasure of introducing to you Linda Hermannspann from HashiCorp. She is a senior recruiter for EMEA there. I'm going to let her introduce herself in a second, but wanted to mention that this has been quite a few weeks in the making. I'm so happy that I finally caught her for this recording. It almost didn't happen. Due to lots of noise, but very happy to talk to her about unbiased recruitment today and all of the best practices that she has to share. But Linda, welcome to the podcast. I'm so happy to have you today.
Well, thank you for having me, Katharina. I'm really glad to be here.
Yeah, me too. I think I'm even more happy than you are to finally catch you on this. I want to kick it off by asking you to introduce yourself to our audience. I'm not sure if anyone's familiar with you. If they're not, then I'll link your LinkedIn after this. But yeah, give us a quick introduction to yourself and then your expertise in recruitment and D&I.
Yeah, sure. So I've actually spent just about 8 years in in-house recruitment with international technology companies, where I guess broadly speaking, partner with different stakeholders on their hiring needs and long-term recruitment strategy, mostly specializing on technical business units, but also with a key focus on DEI initiatives and acting as the talent acquisition DEI ambassador in a specific function, which we'll probably touch on a little bit later. I guess I'm passionate about people and the importance of people in organizations and in particular careers of people, because this is not the first career path I've embarked on, actually. So I first spent 7 years in accounting and tax consultancy, which was very different, to say the least. And then I've spent a few years in the UK working within sales and events management in hospitality. And so, you know, the fact that I was given the opportunity to work in these different careers and to learn what I'm good at and what brings me joy, and then being given the chance to apply all of those learnings and skills into a career within recruitment that brought me the most joy was just really empowering. And I guess that's where most of the passion for careers and people and their careers come from.
That's very interesting. I think most of the recruiters that I speak to have sort of had a more or less classical way into recruitment. I was right out of uni, sort of made their way into businesses. And I think recruitment is quite an easy one to shift into right out of university or sort of rolling into your career. All the more interesting that you've made sort of a jump from different career paths, finding yeah. yourself in this. How did you make that decision to go into recruitment? And why is then D&I important to you in that equation too?
Well, I think it wasn't really a combination of all of the things I was, as I said, very good at. So there is a lot of business acumen that I was able to gain throughout the first 7 years of my career in tax consulting and accountancy, being very, very accurate, very data driven. And then in hospitality, you know, as sales and events manager, it's all about people making, you know, building rapport, understanding people's needs, catering to them in the more literal way, but really just making people feel comfortable and see them, and also kind of work in a very with a very different and diverse slack of people, right? And I think maybe that is where the DEI kind of drive was nestled first, but I think it became clear to me when I first moved into recruitment, or into talent acquisition really, because I was lucky and joined a really diverse team myself. And so additionally to feeling that empowered and being actually selected based on transferable skills rather than having that traditional journey myself, background myself, I just felt so blessed. Then in that first team that I was working with, there were so many people from so many different backgrounds doing the same job of recruiter, but all having a very different perspective, very different area of expertise, working with different business units, and also a very different view on problems and how they approach a problem and bringing so many different aspects to one situation. And that was, I think, really what made me think, I want to recreate this. This is a great environment. I feel so welcome and so fostered. And so then very shortly after moving into recruitment, I ended up already starting building diverse teams in the organization that I first joined. And I think what really drove it home was my first graduate or young professionals program across different regions, meeting, you know, trying to be really as diverse in terms of educational background, personality, drive and desires to bring them together, and then see how successful those young professionals were in the organization and how inspiring they were for so many of the very existing structures and teams. So yeah, I think it all happened very much within the first year or so of me going into recruitment.
What I hear you say is that on the one hand, you definitely experienced the diversity and the impact and the effect that it has for teams, also feeling very included in mm-hmm. that equation of as a maybe a diverse professional yourself. But what I also hear from you is saying, well, you've done it sort of from your own experience, but also in that graduate program, fostering that yeah. diversity among companies that bring in young talent that is very promising.
Yeah.
How does unbiased recruitment fit into that equation? Because I think there is many ways to fostering, promoting diversity at work, fostering inclusion among diverse teams. Where do you see unbiased recruitment slotting into that?
Yeah, unbiased recruitment, which I've only encountered really at HashiCorp, you know, label, is for me twofold. So one is that creating a methodical recruitment process that is based on clearly defined attributes that make somebody successful in a role, and also considering the company culture and team needs, and then assessing the candidates as fairly and objectively as possible against those attributes is one part of, for me, unbiased recruitment. And the second part is probably personal bias, so interviewer bias, I would say, where, you know, those can probably creep in already when you define what is what is, you know, making a candidate successful. But they also more often creep in, I guess, when people are being assessed for a role. So that is where unbiased recruitment for me comes in and focuses on trying to remove as many of these obstacles as possible.
Yeah. How do you then assess candidates in a more general sense? I don't think that you need to disclose everything, how you do everything at HashiCorp, but how do you view then unbiased assessment of candidates if we then later on go into interviews as a separate
topic? I think so. There is ongoing efforts here at HashiCorp, and I think all companies are at different stages of that kind of effort that we are going through right now. And for me, it's having a clear definition of what a role looks like. So for us here at HashiCorp, that would be our wider career matrices, right? We have a company-wide career matrix that defines levels of seniority across all jobs, all job families, and then career matrices by job family. For me, those are different technical roles most of the time. And actually, so it describes really what's expected, what somebody's expected to be able to achieve, but also what makes somebody successful. And obviously the type of the roles change whilst the company matures. So those things are an ongoing effort, like I said, to be always spending time on, okay, what does this person do in this role at that level? With that as the foundation, we would first go and create a job description that reflects those career matrices, responsibilities and attributes. And then we would create an interview process that assesses especially those attributes and technical expertise or just general experience. Most importantly for me is always, if you invest the time in setting up a process like that, it only really works if you try to stick to it, right? So asking the questions consistently that you determine to be important is one thing. And then also, what do you use with this? What do you do with this feedback? How do you use it, right? How do you use the insight you've gained to make an educated hiring decision? And that is a completely different can of worms, right? Enabling your managers or hiring managers to use feedback like that and asking the right questions. So it's a lot of things, I believe, outside of bias and interviewing itself.
Yeah. I like how you cut the assessment question much broader and saying, well, first you need to be clear on what exactly you're hiring for, setting those objective hiring criteria, and then following through until the end. I think a wonderful snippet that you gave us here and saying, well, it doesn't work if you don't stick to it. Investing the time doesn't really make much sense if you have a really well thought out process, a really great structure that keeps you objective. If you can't stick to that, then you've lost the battle there. You mentioned that training hiring managers is a completely different kind of worms. You mentioned in our introductory call that interview trainings are really important to be able to limit bias in interviews. On the one hand, I'd love to hear from you a little bit about how those interview trainings work, sort of what do you focus on? And then on the other hand, how do you make sure that you limit bias indirectly through the hiring managers?
I think there's so much to training and enablement outside of the interview training itself, right? Where, again, I feel very fortunate that HashiCorp does provide a lot of training specifically for all employees, for interviewers specifically, but also very specifically for manager onboarding and training. Specific focuses around bias awareness for the entire company, and then a bit more specific to recruitment and just making sure that all interviewers will have completed those kind of sessions before they can actually participate. Training delivered by talent acquisition is also so wide. I have not experienced that in previous companies where really so much is driven by talent acquisition on enablement of stakeholders. So that's like tool refreshers, right? That's more around maybe a specific process part that is being reviewed, or just really honing in the reminding stakeholders on about the importance of some of the things we're doing. Why are we doing them? We're not just trying to make your life more structured and make it more difficult for you. Those are not just things we are ticking off, but actually there's value in all of these things, guidelines, all of these processes that we have in talent acquisition. And so part of what we're delivering, or what I personally deliver, would be an interview training. I would usually have it run under the very wide headline of interviewing best practices, and discuss with whoever whoever I deliver it to, what might be top of mind for them, and focus in on a few things in more particular. So the ground I would usually cover would be, again, around the importance of creating those processes and questions. But when it comes to the interviewing and bias itself, it would probably be around what types of interview bias or interviewing bias we would usually encounter, like the confirmation bias, like the halo bias, how to potentially be more mindful around assessing, only making note of what the candidates actually say, removing some of the more feeling and judgment kind of statements. And sometimes it's just as simple as a reminder of like inappropriate questions, you know, just a refresher. If people don't interview often, they might be very inclined to ask questions that are illegal. Right. Sometimes it's as simple as that, and saying you should not be asking these kind of questions. But yeah, that's usually the focus. So it's very wide, and then it's being centered around whatever refresher area the audience is looking for.
What kinds of questions are illegal? What do you have on your list where you say this you can't ask this?
Are you planning to be pregnant soon? That's a hard one. But you know, and it also depends really on the country. So this is really unique to which region I'm working in. In some countries, you can actually ask what's your marital status. In others, you can't, right? In most, you can't. But that's not a blanket approach everywhere. But usually here at HashiCorp, we try to be, you know, we're making those questions inappropriate everywhere. If they're inappropriate somewhere, we would usually apply that everywhere, because just because one country doesn't have those DEI protective kind of legislations doesn't mean those questions are making people feel comfortable. So,
yeah, just an add-on, just because they might not be illegal doesn't mean that they're good questions to ask or making people comfortable. So it's a really great policy to say, well, if they're not allowed or sort of frowned upon in one area, then let's just not make use of them at all.
Yeah,
I can imagine that that some people might need a refresher on that, especially if they don't interview very often. Then you do come in also with a feeling of, well, I want to make this a pleasant experience, or I want to figure out the things that are really important to me. But that sometimes gets sidetracked with our own biases that come in, right?
Yeah, I think you're saying a really good thing there. It's a lot of those things that maybe some interviewers that don't interview often would see as like adding value, even like very long icebreakers, very long rapport buildings. Becoming very familiar with a person actually increases the risk of bias creeping in, really. You ending up liking a person or disliking them, and then you see the rest of the interview maybe through that lens. And often, right, for me, the key is, and when I have new interviewers that maybe have never interviewed anywhere, the questions I often get is like, but how do I know what's a good answer and what isn't? And that I often say, well, in reality, you know, the hiring manager would have spent quality time with you and briefing you on what is expected of the role and what are they looking for. But if you are ever in doubt, the most important thing is for you to actually just write down what the candidate is saying. You don't need to be the one judging. You can leave the judgment entirely out. You don't have to say, I recommend or I don't. Just make notes of what actually happened. And then you give us the foundation to sit down with the hiring manager as a recruiter, go through this and come to a decision for you. right? The hiring manager isn't supposed to just blindly follow you yes or no anyway. There should be quality time spent on reviewing feedback. So really good point there.
Yeah, spending a lot of time documenting so that you actually base your decision on evidence that you've gathered from the interview is a great one that you just brought up. What popped to mind for me when you were saying, someone might not know what a good answer looks like. It also comes down to what you said earlier, being very clear on what makes someone successful in a role, making sure that you're clear on the requirements, then you can sort of check them off and say, okay, that can tell they could be good for this, demonstrated knowledge of XYZ. To add on there. Yeah. What advice do you have for those who want to start making interviews more unbiased from a recruiter perspective, who might deal with a breadth of hiring managers with different experiences and expertise?
Well, I think the simplest and easiest to implement, right? That's something you can do immediately tomorrow without overhauling everything, is probably diverse representation in interview panels. I think it's been said 100 times over. I'm not reinventing the wheel here, but the more different voices, and that's not by any particular group that's underrepresented, but really just having a really good mix of personalities in different roles present and assessing a candidate will give you that many different views onto the candidate. And with that, I feel you can ideally remove a lot of bias and just get to the core center of everything. Yeah, I think that's the easiest thing to implement quickly.
Yeah, agreed. Diversity metrics. Mm-hmm. I think this is a topic where we either fall on one side of the spectrum or the other, thinking super valuable, hurting the cause. Where do you lie personally in terms of tracking diversity metrics and having targets?
Yeah, I mean, there is the company-wide kind of approach to it, right? And there is of course data shared around representation a couple of times a year in an all hands, really accessible to everybody. And what I enjoy at HashiCorp about those statistics is that it's mostly used as a cause for celebration and just see like, okay, what happens, that like more around the efforts that are being put into getting to those numbers rather than the number itself. But I do see value in having metrics and having, I think maybe reporting back on metrics around diversity, but there I would personally feel very precious about breaking this down to not just gender or any underrepresented group, but I usually like all of our reports would include, you know, results by region, gender, but also level, the source, like, you know, how was the person entering the company, where have they previously worked, and yes, of course, yes, underrepresented groups to a degree as well, but I think diversity is so much more. So it is
as you say very aptly, it also depends on the region what metrics you can even track, that makes it more nuanced, the conversation itself. And as I hear you talk about it, I think you added a really nice piece, because previously we had a conversation on the podcast about diversity metrics where we talked about, well, it's better for them to be descriptive rather than prescriptive. As soon as you have a goal, then you get into the conversation of positive discrimination, hiring people just for the sake of it, tokenism being sort of roped into that. What you just said now is also really nice as an add-on to say, well, we use it as a chance to celebrate that efforts, to really say, okay, let's not just to look at the number in isolation, but really look at, okay, what have we done to achieve this? Disregarding the fact, well, not really disregarding, but sort of in spite of what the number might actually mean, looking a bit behind what it means in terms of the efforts that are put in.
Yeah, and I do think one of the benefits of having metrics in place for me personally is that you can see, you can probably have more opportunities to see where bias might be creeping into a process. Is there a specific stage that only a specific group passes? Are we already not, as appealing at the stage of job description and advertising our roles? We can really maybe pinpoint better where bias is more present than maybe in other areas. And I think that's what, if anything, then metrics are good for that, to just really keep a quality control aspect to it, as long as you don't lose sight of the bigger picture of diversity meaning so much more than just two different variables that you measure. But it really means every makeup of every team that you look at, do people add different things to the organization? And do they fit in a way that we can look after them and they will feel happy and included, right? And so I think that's what metrics are good for.
Yeah, you brought up a really nice point here as well, to say, well, it's not only about setting up a gender split that you would want, whether that's 30-70 or 50-50 or what have you, or a specific percentage of people from underrepresented groups need to be in the organization, but also looking at metrics that you track anyway, hopefully, application to interview ratio. Yeah. And looking at, okay, how can we split this apart to see, okay, who makes it through from the application to the first interview, for example, who even applies. I think that's a great one, where you have, well, if you have lack of representation, then the job description might not attract a diverse profile of candidates. So those that you mentioned are really nice to also bring into that conversation around diversity metrics, because it's not only about the outcome of, look at the effect, this is how many women we have now, but also about where are the obstacles in that trajectory, in that process, as you say, that keep us from reaching those goals that we might have for representation.
Exactly. Very much a health check to a degree as well, And I mean, it's always nice to have a good score, but there's always something that when you take it apart and dig a bit deeper, that you can still find areas to address. So,
yeah. Now, my last sort of theme that I want to cover with you is stakeholder management. I know that you are very big on that topic, and I think as recruitment being a people function, a people position, a stakeholder management couldn't be more important. Yeah. How does stakeholder management play a role then in recruitment at HashiCorp, and how do you see that fit in?
Well, generally, I think as a recruiter, I think such a key part, as you mentioned, is stakeholder management, because those are your business partner. You are supposed to work with them efficiently, and that they have a need that you are trying to help them with. So, as recruiters, you spend so much time in a one-on-one setting with those stakeholders, building relationships of trust, and which is a key part, right? Building that trust to then be a trusted advisor to guide your stakeholders or hiring managers to get clarity about their roles and their teams and their team needs, and then kind of help them to design these processes that will make them successful at the end, right? To then see it yielded results is hopefully the outcome. But other than the recruiter acting as that business partner, and again, a lot of this is probably built through trust. So often there is a leap of faith when you first start in a company, and you still have to build that relationship and earn that trust. Of course, I get it. but hopefully after a couple of successes, that should be gained. And so I think the stakeholders will over time realize that the questions you ask them, the things you raise, where you might get them thinking about some of the things that they've been doing for a long time that might not serve them or their team or their company anymore, that we have the best for the company and the best for their team in mind, that we're just trying to solve the same problem. I think that's the key nourishing floor of this all. But as a company, we have a lot of enablement, as I mentioned, around workshops and training and so on, but also enablement of the TA team to be those business partners. And I'm part of a group that we call the DEI ambassadors for talent acquisition in particular, which is this group of representatives that tries to listen to stakeholders, but also to their colleagues, but also to just like supporting functions all around and get their get an insight into conversations they're having with their stakeholders. What are you facing? What are you experiencing with your stakeholders, with candidates, with other parts of the business? What pushback do you receive? What has been working well? What hasn't? And then bringing this together in this ambassador group and firstly look at around, okay, where are we? What are the reoccurring themes? What can we do better? And also, you know, decide like where is maybe additional enablement needed. And very often this group, and especially talent acquisition, but driven by this group, would be doing like roadshows around specific enablement topics, saying, okay, here, let's say neurodiversity, you know, as a topic, and coming up with, okay, how can we, what are we experiencing there right now? What are some of the pushbacks? How can we address it? How can we encourage managers to be open to consider people that might have a neurodiverse background? What do those people need from us? And how can we accommodate them and be more inclusive? And then, yeah, just build a concept around it, build material and go and travel through the company, engaging stakeholders. And I think talent acquisition at HashiCorp is often seen as that advisory function, which again, I'm very, very lucky to be in an environment like that. But I think there's a lot that I personally can take from this experience at HashiCorp, should it ever drive me into a different direction, that is super useful and super applicable to other businesses very easily, even outside of all of this great framework of TA ambassadors, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. I think you answered already my subsequent question, but I'm going to do a quick summary and then you let me know if that's apt. I was going to ask you, how do you establish then strong relationships with stakeholders, i.e. hiring managers, because those are the hardest ones to manage their expectations. One being the network that you have, sort of that roadshow idea of going around educating people around topics of diversity, topics of inclusion that really touch the TA function. I think that's one that you mentioned. And then also spending a lot of time talking to them. At least that's what I heard from you, sort of having that consistent rapport with them to be able to establish that basis of trust, as you mentioned earlier. I think those are the two that I gathered. Do you want to add anything to that or expand on any of those?
I think now that I hear your summary, good summary, I want to add listening. It's probably more about listening than about talking, because talking, you know, you don't want your stakeholders to become a disengaged audience. That's not the mindset we need. So I want them to feel listened to. I want to hear how they perceive their team and how they perceive their hiring needs how they perceive the industry and what's the story they tell themselves about recruitment, about their team and what's needed. And then kind of encourage them to use all of these amazing tools we have. We're so lucky that HashiCorp is providing us with so many cool tools that assist us in that journey of being less biased and being super automated and super productive. And just make them realize that if we work together on this, that it's going to be a piece of cake eventually, right? That all of this good work and the preparation time and all of these conversations and all of that assessing of your own bias and getting that into that position, that it will be so rewarding long term. That's probably the aspect I would add.
Yeah, emphasizing the common goal while listening to what they actually are struggling with, listening to how they're challenging maybe your invitation to be more educated around bias, adopting those tools and processes. My last question is around on the one hand, best practices that you want to sort of share with everyone to think, okay, this has really worked for me as a recruiter, anything that you can implement tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And then on the other side, maybe a learning that you had to learn the hard way. If you can share sort of something where you think, this is something that I really want everyone to know without going into detail. Of course, you don't need to divulge everything.
So I think just to not repeat what I've been saying, because I, you know, be tempted to go back and to invest the time into the preparation and setup of a recruitment process upfront, and then it will be running smoothly, hopefully later on. I don't want to go back to that. And so I think I would want to encourage people in the recruitment profession to ask questions and to be brave enough to ask questions and maybe educate yourself on how to best question when you see bias creeping in, right? And here at HashiCorp, we're very encouraged and enabled to ask those questions and apply different practices to do that. So when you see any of the behavior creeping in where you're like, this doesn't feel right, just be brave and sit down with your stakeholder and ask what made you come to this evaluation, or what made you feel this way about a candidate? You know, why is this important to you? What is this based on? And then open a conversation, and often you'll actually find once the person that you think has displayed some bias will potentially come to their own conclusion of, oh, this might be my personal lens, this is my own judgment. And I think that's just one of the things. It takes so much courage to get to a point where you feel empowered to ask people and question people's behavior and outcome. But rather than taking the feedback of a person for granted, if you spot something, be brave and ask why this is, because it can't really hurt. And I think one thing I feel, is also something actually right ties in with that I've learned is that I'm not alone. There is no shame in escalating situations to your leaders, right? And feeling supported by all the way up to your talent acquisition VP, and rather than feel like I personally always, which is probably my personality, I fail if I'm not able to take care of this. Then you know what a professional am I? But knowing that other people may have had the same issues, and being able to show I've done everything that I could think of always helped me actually hearing from more experienced people, probably like, have you tried this? Oh, I haven't thought about it. And I can maybe go and try myself again. Or I can actually leave it with somebody that is in a more influential position within the company, and they can take this on for me and I'm not alone.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing those two tips. I think very relatable what you just said. I think lots of people are prone to just figure out it out by themselves because of that sort of can-do attitude that we're all looking for at companies, or because of shame of feeling like, well, I should be able to deal with this. I don't really need or want to share this or escalate it. But thank you for sharing that. I think that's a very good encouragement for lots of people who might be struggling with that. And I think there's lots in the D&I space that feel like they can't really open up. Before I let you go, though, I know that you at HashiCorp have your own podcast that I would love for you to plug. It's about talent development and women in tech. But tell us a little bit more about it in case our listeners are interested.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is not our first podcast, but we've received such a positive resonance to the stories that especially our diverse folks at HashiCorp, especially in technical roles, had to share with the industry, that we felt it was time for a more women in tech focused podcast. So I'm really proud that the first episode is actually around careers, developing careers as women in tech. And I'm super excited that the people that are guests in this podcast episode are actually people from a diverse background that have entered a career in in technology from very different paths, similarly to myself, but I'm also not deeply technical, but very interesting stories, very encouraging. And I hope this is just the start of many encouraging and empowering podcast episodes around, how to be impactful, how to be integrated, and how to be happy in technology as a woman.
Super nice. Whether you are an ally or a woman in tech, I think you should check this out. I'm gonna right after this gonna go and listen to the first episode. We are recording this quite in advance, so there'll be plenty more episodes out at the time that you're listening to this, so you can go back and listen to the backlog all at once. Thank you so much for joining me today, Linda. I really hope you enjoyed it. I definitely did. Learned a lot of new things about you, about HashiCorp, about anything that is sort of best practice related. I think you shared a lot today, which you've been very generous with your time and your best practices. So thank you so much.
It was a pleasure, Katerina. So thanks again for having me. It would be nice if we can keep connecting in this way or any other. And love the work you do.
Thank you so much. And we definitely will keep in touch and see how we can collaborate in the future and just keep each other in the loop of the things we do. Thank you so much for everyone who listened today. I hope you like this episode. Please rate us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Haven't said that before, but please do. It helps us out a lot. Also, let us know what you took away from this episode. Connect with Linda on LinkedIn. I'll share her LinkedIn profile so you can connect with her there. And go follow the HashiCorp podcast as well and have a listen. And that leaves me with only one more thing to say, which is I hope that you visit us again the next one. There'll be a next one out in 2 weeks' time. And have a good one. Bye.